From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Earlier today, I ordered American forces to strike Iraq. Our missiles sent the following message to Saddam Hussein. When you abuse your own people or threaten your neighbors, you must pay a price.
President Clinton slams Iraq with 27 cruise missiles to teach Saddam Hussein a lesson about aggression. School boards and the Christian right. It's back to school time. We'll bring you the first in a series of reports on public education and how race and the economy affect the 1996 elections. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton says the U.S. missile attack on Iraq sends the message that Saddam Hussein can't abuse his people or threaten Iraq's neighbors. The president says any further action will depend on what Saddam does now. His comment comes in reaction to Saddam's announcement that he will no longer recognize the no-fly zones in both northern and southern Iraq that are being enforced by Allied planes. Clinton says the use of cruise missiles against Iraqi military targets was a measured response to the Iraqi takeover of a Kurdish enclave in protected northern Iraq over the weekend.
First, we are extending the no-fly zone in southern Iraq. This will deny Saddam control of Iraqi airspace from the Kuwaiti border to the southern suburbs of Baghdad and significantly restrict Iraq's ability to conduct offensive operations in the region. Second, to protect the safety of our aircraft enforcing this no-fly zone, our cruise missile struck Saddam's air defense capabilities in southern Iraq. The United States was a co-sponsor of United Nations Security Resolution 986, which allows Iraq to sell amounts of oil to purchase food and medicine for its people, including the Kurds. Erbil, the city seized by the Iraqis, is a key distribution center for this aid. Until we are sure these humanitarian supplies can actually get to those who need them, the plan cannot go forward, and the Iraqi government will be denied the new resources it has been expecting. Saddam Hussein's objectives may change, but his methods are always the same: violence and aggression against the Kurds, against other ethnic minorities, against Iraq's neighbors. Our answer to that recklessness must be strong.
President Clinton speaking earlier today about the U.S. bombing of Iraq. The U.S. cruise missile strikes on targets in Iraq brought mixed reaction today. The British Foreign Secretary said that they support what the United States has done, as does Germany and Japan. But in Moscow, a source in the Russian Foreign Ministry, quoted by Interfax News Agency, said the situation in the Gulf was extremely dangerous. In Cairo, the foreign ministry spokesperson said Egypt is following with deep concern the current incidents on the Iraqi land. And France withheld its support, making its reservations clear in a foreign ministry statement, which said Paris had been informed in advance of the operation but made no comment on the merits of the raid. Spain, one of the United States' NATO allies, said it wished Washington had delayed the strike. Here at home, Bob Dole is suggesting weak leadership by President Clinton resulted in the need for action against Saddam Hussein as he ventures where presidential candidates often have feared to tread, mixing politics and foreign policy during a crisis. The Republican nominee was expected to spell out his views on the developments in Iraq today in a speech to a convention of the American Legion, the nation's largest veterans organizations. But Dole advisers said late yesterday they understood a military response from the Clinton administration to the latest crisis was underway and were just waiting to see the consequences. Joining us now on Democracy Now! To talk about the U.S. bombing of Iraq is a Middle East correspondent with the independent newspaper. Robert Fisk has been based in Beirut for more than 20 years and covers the region. Welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you first share your reaction to what the United States did earlier this morning?
Well, I suppose my reaction is the one that will appear in my newspaper under my name in a few hours' time. This seems to me to be a very odd response to what is, in fact, an inter-Kurdish civil war. One of the leading parties, whose people the Allies are supposed to be protecting in northern Iraq, was the same party which invited the Iraqis to enter Erbil. So on the one hand, in order to protect the people, or some of the people, who had since allied themselves to the Iraqi regime, the Americans are bombing the Iraqi regime. So it's not as simple as it sounds when, for example, you hear President Clinton's public statement just over an hour ago. My second reaction, and perhaps the larger, more long-term one, is that this is a very selective moral indignation on the part of the United States. Mr. Clinton said, and I made a note of it in my handwriting, the message was, when you abuse your own people or threaten your neighbors, you must pay the price. Now, he's right in the sense that Saddam Hussein is indeed an evil, wicked, vicious man. I have no doubt of that, and I've been to Iraq many times. However, there are, unfortunately, many other regions of the Middle East which have abysmal human rights records. In running up to this bombardment, for example, General Shalikashvili and Robert Pelletreau went to see President Mubarak of Egypt. I bet they did not raise with President Mubarak the fact that his state security police routinely torture people with electricity, that punishments in prison include rape, and that at least 20 Egyptian prisoners have died in less than 2 years in the prisons of Egypt. These people are opponents of the regime who've been accused of violent acts. When they were consulting the Bahraini government of its views, for example, on the bombing, the forthcoming bombing of Iraq, I doubt very much if the U.S. officials raised with Sheikh Issa of Bahrain the fact that torture is routine from the state security force in the island, that a Jordanian army colonel is the chief torturer, and he is the translator for the man that runs the security apparatus, who's a former British special branch officer called Ian Henderson. I doubt when the Americans spoke to the Saudis that they discussed with them the habit of cutting the heads off alleged murderers, including women who have their scarves and their scarves removed before a man cuts their head off with a sword. So this is a very, very selective moral indignation we're seeing here. If B-52s are going to head off from Guam every time the American president identifies a ruthless Arab regime, they're going to have a lot of work to do, and they're going to be bombing most of the West's allies as well as its enemies. So that part of it I find rather disturbing, the fact that we are being asked as Westerners to support on moral grounds something which is being applied so selectively as to be, in a sense, taking sides in the Middle East.
Robert Fisk, let me ask you about Turkey. Turkey is a close U.S. ally. It is known for bombing the Kurds, although it is not known to be broadcast from the White House.
No, Turkey is allowed to bomb the Kurds because they're on our side. The Turks have now carried out 3 major raids right into the protected zone, which we Westerners like to think we're protecting the Kurds in their battle, their very brutal battle, against the extremely brutal Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK. The PKK have since taken their war, their Kurdish war, across into the Kurdish areas of Turkey. And Turkey itself, I might go back to my previous point, if you look in the list of Index on Censorship and Amnesty International and the major humanitarian organizations, Turkey goes down as one of the largest offenders of human rights, particularly in terms of prisons, disappearances, death squads, and so on. Turkey, of course, at the same time, has a rather ambivalent position. On the one hand, they don't want to get in the bad books of the United States. On the other hand, they're very concerned that Iraq will break up into mini-states and that a Kurdish mini-state will destabilize southeastern Turkey. So for this reason, they are keeping open good relations with Iraq and have, in fact, been trying to establish some new form of petroleum route between Turkey and Baghdad. So Turkey has an ambivalent role. It wants to stay in with the West. It wants to join the European Union. It probably hasn't got much chance at the moment with its human rights record, but it would like to. And within the country itself, of course, you've also got this growing Islamism, as you have in almost every Muslim country of the Middle East, which is, in a sense, a protest against years of Western policies towards the region.
Can you explain why it is or how it is the U.S. chooses its allies in the region? Would you say it's all oil politics?
I think they choose their allies in the region by intimidating them, by paying for them, by seeking those who will want to do business with the West. And this is a complicated process, and it shouldn't be seen in quite the simplified terms that I have to put it because we're talking on a radio station. Look, for example, look at the peace process, which we still, I suppose, have to call it, the Oslo Agreement and the peace between Israel and Jordan, the peace between Israel and the Palestinians and the peace between Israel and Jordan. If we remember, back in 1991, the only two Arab leaders to embrace Saddam Hussein after he had invaded Kuwait were King Hussein of Jordan and Yasser Arafat of the PLO. And we were all encouraged by Western statesmen, politicians, PR men, CNN, to write these people off. They were doomed, they were finished, they'd taken the wrong side, their moral opprobrium attached to them. And lo and behold, what happened? They became so broken economically, so broken morally in the eyes, not only particularly of other Arabs or the West, but also in danger of being overthrown, that they then clutched at the only straw left open to them for survival, and that was using the Americans to make peace with Israel. And so we now are asked, and we never are reminded of the past and the Saddam Hussein episode, we now are asked to admire the courage of King Hussein and the pragmatism of that great statesman Yasser Arafat, who overnight was transformed from super terrorist to super statesman the moment he signed on the dotted line. That is how we choose and make our friends in the Middle East.
Again, you're listening to Robert Fisk, and I should say Robert Fisk of The Independent, a British newspaper, recently won the top reporting prize from, you could tell us the name of it, that was determined by British editors of the best reporter.
I hate to tell you this, I won three prizes this year, but the Foreign Press Association award I got, yes, that's right, and I got the British one for foreign reporting as well.
And I should say that these are viewpoints that are not often heard in the United States just in the last 12 hours since the U.S. bombed Iraq. What we're getting very much from the mainstream press, from broadcast, from CNN, is the view of the Pentagon. In fact, directly from the Pentagon, also often standing in the Pentagon or in the State Department. But let me ask you, let me ask you this question. It is about the politics of the Kurds. For people to understand who the Kurds are in the various countries where they are, and what is this wish for an independent Kurdistan?
Right. I suppose a boxed, quick, pricey history. Kurds have lived on the land that we call Kurdistan for about 4,000 years. They are of mixed origin. They are Caucasian, Turkish, Arab. Today they are Sunni Muslims, although they were Christian at one point in the past. Indeed, one of the most famous Kurds of all time, who will be known in America, was Saladin, the great Muslim conqueror who defeated the Crusaders in the Middle East in the, I was going to say the 11th, the 12th century. The real first moment for the Kurds to have a nation came, I think, in 1918, when President Woodrow Wilson made his famous 14 points declaration, in which he referred to a future Kurdish homeland, which he hoped would emerge from the Ottoman Empire with the end of the First World War. And now this Kurdish state would have included the northeastern part of Syria, the southeastern part of Turkey, part of, well, what is modern-day Armenia, and the Kurdish areas of northern Iraq, which is where they are still. But the problem was that Britain, which of course still then possessed a mighty empire, wanted Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq. They wanted the oil, of course. And the French wanted the oil fields at Kirkuk in northern Iraq. And the Turks took control of their bit of Kurdistan. By this stage, the Turks were back on their feet again. And the new Soviet Union, the revolution had only taken place a couple of years before, took control of the Armenian bit of Kurdistan. So Kurdistan was doomed to be the largest nation on earth without a state, and it has stayed that way ever since. And throughout the period of British rule, there were Kurdish uprisings, which were put down with great brutality by the British Royal Air Force. They bombed civilian camps, and gas was used against the Kurds. The RAF commander, in fact, in Iraq at this time in the 30s, who was even criticized by the bellicose Winston Churchill for ruthlessness, was a certain man called Arthur Harris, who was Marshal of the Air Force, Sir Arthur Harris, was later to order the destruction of the German city of Dresden in February 1945, a bombing in which more than 100,000 people were killed, all of them, most of them civilians. Pretty grim precedents in Kurdistan then. Now, if, I suppose this is a way of putting it, if one of the most prominent characteristics of the Kurds is courage, and we have all admired them, and I've personally witnessed this, the other characteristic, I'm afraid, is their suicidal tribal habit of feuding among each other. And again over the past 50 years, the opportunity of statehood has slipped from their grasp because of internal rivalries. We have the Stalinist Kurdish Workers' Party, PKK, who are alienating the nationalists. We had Masoud Barzani's Kurdish Democratic Party maintaining a relationship of suspicion and alliance with the Baghdad regime, while Jalal Talabani's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan saw some hope in help from Iran. Barzani's Kurds, under the leadership of his father, were originally betrayed back in 1975 in their struggle against Baghdad, when Henry Kissinger and the CIA and the then Shah of Iran turned their backs on their friendship with Barzani because they wanted to make friends with Baghdad.
And then Robert Fisk, let me ask, talking about turning their backs on the Kurds, what about after the Persian Gulf War with President Bush?
Absolutely. As we know, they rose up again after the Iraqis were driven out of Kuwait, when President Bush called on the subject peoples of Iraq, including the Kurds, to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And in the aftermath of that liberation, we watched as town after town, city after city in the south, Shiite south, as well as the Kurdish north of Iraq, fell to liberation forces. And so the Kurds loyally followed President Bush's call, only to be betrayed again. And it was the plight of these same Kurds streaming through the frozen mountainsides in terror of Saddam that forced the Western allies, partly, I think, through a guilty conscience, to clear a safe haven for them in northern Iraq. The problem was that they still went on fighting each other throughout that time. I remember going from a food distribution center in those frozen mountains, and just down the road I found two Kurdish groups of alleged liberation fighters killing each other. They were having a battle. Of course, what's happened most recently is that the Iranians moved artillery in to support the PUK in its battle with Barzani of the Kurdish Democratic Party. And it was Barzani who invited the Iraqis, or who appears to have invited the Iraqis, into Erbil last week. And so this latest crisis, if that's what we now have to call it, is part of a Kurdish civil war. And it's a war in which the Americans have now become involved.
Robert Fisk, why did the U.S. bomb southern Lebanon if the Kurds are in northern southern Iraq if the Kurds are in northern Iraq?
That was a very exotic idea of bomb aiming for a moment there. The American version, as we know, is that if they bomb in the south at selected targets, there is less chance of killing civilians. You have to remember that in early 1993, after America complained of the use of anti-aircraft weapons in southern Iraq, they fired Tomahawk cruise missiles, one of which hit a large hotel in Baghdad and killed the hotel receptionist in front of the world's press. You may remember that in June of 1993, in retaliation for a plot to kill President Bush, the court case in Kuwait had not actually finished, but the Americans obviously felt that they knew who the guilty party were, the Americans fired more Tomahawk cruise missiles at Baghdad. On this occasion, one of those missiles killed one of the most prominent modern painters in Iraq, a woman. Mr. Clinton afterwards, when he was asked what he thought about the results of the bombings, he was on his way to church in the United States, and he said he thought Americans could feel good about what had happened. He claimed, of course, and indeed it may have been true, that military targets were also hit. I think the real thing is that the Americans realize that there is a great danger of this having repercussions if there are television pictures of lots of dead civilians. The difference, of course, or rather the point is that the real effect is not going to be in the United States. It's not going to be in any demonstrations by people who decide they don't like the war in Iraq. The real problem, which America has still not got to grips with but has beginning to understand, is the effect in the Arab world. It's among the Arabs, who are supposed to be our friends, who are supposed to be our allies, whom we do not criticize for human rights abuses, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, etc., that there is growing disenchantment and in some cases hatred with the West, politics, culture, policy, all it stands for, and of course its support for Israel. And it is among these people, people who ultimately could rise up to threaten those regimes which we consider to be friendly and pro-Western, who will be watching the results of these air attacks with much more concentration and tension than we in the West will. And I think the Americans are very concerned, or they should be very concerned, that the effect of these bombardments doesn't have a negative response in the Arab world. My feeling is that it will.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Robert Fisk of the Independent newspaper. He is based in Beirut, Lebanon. You're listening to Democracy Now! I should say that all of the countries he just named in the Arab world have not come out in support of this bombing. And of course, it is an election year. And overall, Bob Dole has supported President Clinton in the bombing of Iraq, although he is calling for an increase in military spending. We'll be back in 60 seconds to look at education. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. For over a decade, the religious right has been waging a grassroots battle over the hearts and minds of school children. The struggle, which at first focused around curricula, has widened over the past few years to include a debate over how and even if education would be funded publicly. For the next 4 days, producer Barbara Bernstein will take us to the front lines of the culture wars in the classroom. Her series is called Carefully Taught: Clashing Values in the Classroom.
I say this: if education were a war, you would be losing it. If it were a business, you would be driving it into bankruptcy. If it were a patient, it would be dying.
Bob Dole's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention included a surprise attack on public education and teachers' unions. But to people who keep a close eye on the religious right, Dole's attack was no surprise. It could have been scripted by the right-wing think tanks that supply the ammunition in the culture wars. This rhetoric has long been spouted by conservative activists like Rosie Avila, a school board trustee in Orange County, California.
Actually, schools are no longer just sweet little schools, but they're actually being managed by the federal government. So you're becoming a partner with the federal government in raising your children.
John Dewey set out to create an educational system, and Horace Mann and the rest of them, to create a society of people that were too ignorant to oppose slavery and captivity into a socialist-dominated government.
Anti-gay activist Kevin Thibodeau is the former director of Colorado for Family Values.
I don't think the public schools are a safe place to send your kids anymore.
Some people who are conservative evangelicals will tell you that the public education system has to be destroyed because it's what's destroying America.
Chip Burleigh is with Political Research Associates in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Other people will keep their children in public schools and go into the school system and create turmoil because they really don't want the school system to work. And then there's a lot of people who have children in the public schools who want the curricula to reflect their values. And they believe in these conspiracy theories about John Dewey and secular humanism and how the National Education Association is involved in psychological manipulation on behalf of socialism and all of these charges that you hear. And so they're in the public school setting, especially active with school boards, to object to any curricula that they find offensive.
The religious right's impact on public education is being felt across the country. It began in the early 90s when the Christian Coalition and other Christian evangelical groups were successful in taking over local school boards by running stealth candidates. Many of these people have since worked their way up the political ranks and are now making themselves heard in state legislatures.
I think California public education is in a lot of turmoil right now. We have some extremists sitting on both the Senate and the Assembly Education Committees.
Kathy Frasco lives in San Diego County, where the religious right began to build its current base of support in California by running candidates for local office. In 1990, 60 Christian Coalition-sponsored candidates out of a slate of 90 won seats on local school boards and other governmental bodies in the county. 2 years later, conservative evangelicals gained control of the Vista School Board in northern San Diego County and completely transformed how that school district did its business.
One of their first steps, of course, was to initiate their meetings with a prayer. Then they started looking into the curriculum so that they could introduce creationism. They eventually did manage to bring creationism into social studies and history. They removed from the health ed curriculum any mention of homosexuality or abortion or masturbation.
Someone advised eighth grade young boys which lubricant to use with condoms. This guy ought to be fired. There ought to be somebody held accountable, and he ought to be absolutely accountable.
The meetings held at the Vista High School board were very contentious. There were people who would actually sit on the right-hand side, and those were all of the conservatives. The meetings went well until 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. They were vicious. People booed. They hissed. People stood outside and argued all the time.
You are responsible for indoctrinating a bunch of kids into homosexuality.
Everyday school business was affected deeply. The morale of the teachers was very, very low.
I believe that the kind of revolution that is taking place here, I can tell you, is taking place in state after state after state.
Robert Sweet of the National Right to Read Foundation addressing a gathering of conservative school board members in Long Beach, California in December of 1995.
2 weeks ago, I was in Milwaukee to the parents raising educational standards in schools. And they were all coming together to do the same kind of work that you are doing, to elect school board members. The most important position in this country right now are school board members. In my opinion, that's the most important position that anybody can hold, because we spend more money on education than in any other area of our society.
I got elected to the school board in 1991.
Ken Coleman lives in Merrimack, New Hampshire.
About 6 months before I started to run for re-election, we started to see pamphlets coming out in the town, such as the Phyllis Schlafly Report, attempting to indicate that we had a school system out of control. There was a lot of information put out trying to claim that we had a clandestine plot to introduce condoms in the first grade. And what they did literally was scare a town that had been very sleepy around school issues because we hadn't had any problem. And in a very close election, which I estimate that some of these outside right groups spent over $10,000 against me in, I lost by 3 votes. That brought in this current board majority who over the next year put in a moment of silence, attempted to put creationism in the schools, have de-emphasized problem-solving and critical thinking skills, have torn apart the health curriculum. Now, one of our school board members is a statewide coordinator of the Christian Coalition school board campaigns, even though the Christian Coalition still says they don't get involved in school board elections. That's kind of an interesting title for an organization that doesn't get involved in school board elections.
In 1992, two new trustees got elected to our school district who were decidedly anti-public education in their agenda.
Susie Schwartz is a parent and community activist in Southern Orange County, California.
One trustee in particular, Debbie Hughes, started to use her position as a trustee and to go around and hold these little private meetings in people's homes and at churches to discuss what was really going on in public education. I attended one of the meetings, which was held at a local church. What she did was an excellent job of taking a little bit of truth and a lot of fiction, and she wove a tale that was quite a horror story about her public schools. And I knew much of what she was saying was entirely false based on my own personal experience helping in the classroom, talking to principals, talking to people at the school district, trying to be a very informed parent. And what galled me and concerned me most was this woman does not have her child in public school. She homeschools her child.
Debbie Hughes, Saddleback Union school board member, claims she took her son out of public school as a result of a disturbing incident.
My son was given a test in his civics class in high school, and he came home and told me about this test, and he had questions on it like, do you always obey your parents, and do you think that they always have your best interest in mind? What kind of discipline do your parents give you? Do they spank you? If they do, is it with an open hand, a closed hand, or a belt? I felt very violated as a parent. And then when I asked to see it, I was told I couldn't.
She came right out and said the purpose of the California Learning Assessment System, the class test, was to find out what your child's moral was regarding certain things, and then proceed to change it to what was considered to be the politically correct attitude. And she has traveled around the state of California with Gary Creep of the U.S. Justice Foundation, and they say they're with the State of California Education Task Force, which doesn't really appear to exist at all, or at least not that anyone at the State of California is aware of.
And let me introduce myself. My name is Gary Creep. I'm Executive Director of the United States Justice Foundation. We're a legal group that provides free legal advice to school boards and school board members and parents groups all over California and to a lesser extent all over the country. I sued in 1994 17 school districts around the state over the class test. We're the ones that were doing that. And forgive me, Lord, for being conceited, but I think that without the lawsuits, you still have the class test, because it's because of the publicity generated by the lawsuits that people found out about it and started doing something.
I personally believe that they view us as a bunch of right-wing fanatical fundamentalist Christian nuts.
Frank Urie helped organize a network of conservative school board members in California. At the annual California School Board Association convention in 1995, he failed to get his group official caucus status, so they held their own two-day conference at a hotel across the street from the convention. While the CSBA convention emphasized a diversity of issues confronting educators, the conservative caucus workshops focused narrowly on back-to-basics curricula, stopping federal funding for education, and how to break the teachers' union. Urie shared with his conservative colleagues his ongoing battle with the School Board Association.
And I said, as long as you keep trying to hide behind labeling us as religious right, you will miss the points that we're trying to bring up. Academic accountability, academic excellence, trying to limit the control of labor unions, trying to push for real standards in academics. The easiest thing we could do right now is go home, pack our kids off to private school, and say, we're done with it. That would be the easy response. That's not what we're all about, because we need to have our voices heard.
These conservative school board members have allies like Steve Baldwin, who, as chair of the California State Assembly Education Committee, is trying to pass legislation that would weaken the California State Board of Education and make it impossible for the state to receive any federal funding for education. With his help, they may not be far from realizing their goals.
It's our hope that eventually the decentralization of power will lead to more conservatives and more parents being involved in the school board process and lead to more control of school boards by people who share our views in education.
While the religious right continues their push to take over school boards all over the country, many of their early victories have been overturned. Ken Coleman from Merrimack, New Hampshire, regained his school board seat, and in the following election, moderates and progressives were returned to power in a landslide victory. The conservative majority of the Vista, California school board was recalled in 1994, and moderates reclaimed that school board as well. But Kathy Frasca from San Diego County does not feel that it is time yet for progressives and moderates to celebrate any long-term victories.
People had better keep their guard up. Most school boards in this county are only a heartbeat away from having a religious right majority on them again.
For Democracy Now!, this is Barbara Bernstein reporting.
Tomorrow on Democracy Now!, producer Barbara Bernstein will examine the struggle over funding public education and the battle over school choice. The series, Carefully Taught, Clashing Values in the Classroom, is part of a two-hour documentary that will air on alternative radio later this fall. We're now joined by someone who's fighting the school board battles on the front lines. Poppy Dennis of Del Mar, California, is founder and executive director of the Community Coalition Network, a group that trains and runs progressive school board candidates. I should also say she was a delegate to the Democratic Convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Poppy.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us, was this familiar, the stories you have heard in Barbara's piece?
Absolutely. All too familiar, and it's happening not just in Vista, but in other areas. By the way, I think I like to call those folks religious political extremists. you know, because they don't really represent Christians, and definitely I would like to also remind people that they do spread deliberate distortions. So
why did you get involved with school board elections as opposed to other kinds of elections?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I think that, number one, schools are so important. They're the breeding grounds for democracy. They develop the critical thinking skills necessary for people to vote intelligently. And they're also, in California at least, they're the most local or grassroots, small type of district where people can really identify with the impact that decisions have on their families and kids. So it's a good place to start.
Now, at the Democratic National Convention last week, you were part of the California delegation. Also, you attended the Education Caucus. Now, what is the Education Caucus and school board elections really have to do with Democrats and Republicans? Do you run along those lines?
School boards, well, that was going to say another reason why it's important to get involved, why we like school boards is because they are nonpartisan. And that way you can get people involved in all parties. One of the caucuses that I went to was about fighting extremism in the schools, and we had someone there from the Interfaith Alliance.
Which is?
The Interfaith Alliance is, thankfully, it's a group of ministers and religious leaders from all different faiths who are getting together to address this issue and trying to work with the press and assert the fact that the Christian Coalition doesn't speak for them. In fact, it doesn't speak for most Christians. And so they're, in a sense, trying to bring back to the public the idea that these people are not just Christians, they're extremists.
How successful is the Christian Coalition in organizing in your community in Del Mar, California?
Well, my community really is San Diego County. Del Mar itself is a small town, and they haven't had any inroads there. However, in San Diego County, they've been very successful. Steve Baldwin, that was quoted there earlier, is from East County, and we have school board members that are affiliated with the coalition all throughout the county. They've also been influential in getting teachers to be members and in subtly doing things like getting their point of view introduced through students.
Let me ask you, in this election year, what are your goals with Community Coalition Network? What do you hope to accomplish?
Well, I think it's very, very important to take a positive step and look at how we can counter these and reinvigorate democracy. I think we really need to do it through informed involvement. We need to bring people together to spread the information, to combat the misinformation that's being spread, to get people into the schools, to get them to go to board meetings, to see what's happening, to put out there the kinds of ridiculous things these people are saying, and also to get leaders to know what's happening and to support moderate people of any particular party who's running for the school boards.
What kind of criterion does a person have to meet to run for the school board?
Well, there are certain criteria that the Community Coalition Network looks for, but also anybody can run for school board. You don't even have to have a student in the school. But to me, a good school board member should have been involved in the school, should have their kids in school, should have something to
provide. Right. But isn't it even different than voting for president? For example, do you have to be a citizen?
You do have to be a citizen and a registered voter to run for school board, but that's about it. You don't have to have any knowledge, but in particular.
If people want to get in touch with the Community Coalition Network, the group that you founded and are executive director, what is your phone number?
Area code 619-72. Whoops, I guess they could call me at home. 619-755-6949.
One more time.
619-755-6949.
And is there anything special this year in the election year for president that you're doing differently than you've done in the past, in fact, coming out of the Democratic Convention yourself?
Well, I myself as an individual and as a teacher feel that there's absolutely a clear choice in terms of the presidency, because you have one president who's been very pro-public education, who's been for tolerance, for critical thinking skills, all those kinds of things. But of course, the Community Coalition Network does not have any partisan input in terms of president or any other partisan offices.
Well, we're going to continue the discussion on education this week as kids start going back to school. We want to thank Poppy Dennis, founder and executive director of the Community Coalition Network, a group that is based in Del Mar, California. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. While much national attention is being paid to November's presidential election, perhaps the fiercest political battleground this fall will be in the House of Representatives, where Newt Gingrich and the GOP hope to hang on to their new majority while Democrats fight to throw the Republican revolutionaries out. Both Democrats and Republicans are already saying they'll conduct major voter registration drives in districts favorable to their candidates. For the Democrats, registering and then motivating Americans' Black and Latino communities to vote may be the key to success in 1996. But it may not be easy for Bill Clinton's party to get votes from people of color this year, as employment statistics continue to show wide disparities in who's working, who's unemployed, and who's making a living in this economy. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky spoke recently with Gary Delgado and Libera Della Piano of the Applied Research Center in Oakland, California, about the issues of race, economics, and the 1996 elections.
Gentlemen, the situation for people of color in the United States, as far as taking advantage of what the economy is producing now, we're in a period of perceived boom times when the economy is supposed to be coming back up. Bill Clinton thinks this is going to reelect him. What's the reality that you discovered in doing your survey, Deliberate Disadvantage?
One of the things that we discovered is that when you look at the economy in general, you certainly can see that there are certain sectors that are booming. But in order to understand what's happening, in particular to communities of color, you have to disaggregate the data. So, for instance, we have a situation in the Bay Area where five Army bases were closed, and that was a loss of 60,000 jobs. But 40% of those jobs are held by people of color. Therefore, there's a disproportionate impact on people of color in the Bay Area, and that's the kind of impact that people tend not to look at in aggregate data.
You had some solutions that you suggested to the situations that you discovered. By the way, let's talk a little bit more about the situations. One of the things that struck me the most in reading around in your report was the talking about the suburbanization of America and the suburbanization of jobs. 86% of the people of the United States, you come up with an interesting statistic, 86% of the people of the United States now live in communities where there are fewer than 1% African Americans. What is the impact of having these kind of increasingly racially segregated areas in the United States?
Well, not only are they racially segregated in housing, but they're also excluded from transportation. So that what happens is, as you know, there's this boom in the economy, new jobs are being created. They're being created in non-urban areas, in new technologies where people don't have a foothold, and people of color in particular don't have a foothold. And then you have no transportation between city centers where people of color are traditionally located and these suburban economic boom centers like the I-680 corridor in Northern California, where there's this big technological boom. And I'm sure that this follows through in other places around the country also.
You had a really fascinating statistic that you discovered here in Silicon Valley in Northern California, where you found that about 82% of the people who work as unskilled laborers in Silicon Valley are people of color, whereas white males make up 80.5% of officials and managers. Just complete balance on two sides of the scale. People of color at the lower end with the worst jobs, white males having the upper end of the jobs. As you look at this, what the companies always will tell you is that, well, this is changing. As time goes by, it'll change. Is it changing?
It may change in a particular company, or it may change, slightly over an industry. But in general, it isn't. And that, you know, in fact, what we found is that in new industries, in fact, it's sometimes worse than it was in the old industries, which are disappearing. So
why would that be true?
Well, it's true, one, because of the transportation issue. It's also true because of a lack of access to education, schools. Where there's majority people of color have less access to computers in an early age, and they don't have a head start. And those are a number of reasons, and there are more.
You came up with solutions in your report, 8 Ways to Work for Change, and I was interested to see that you had solutions like supporting affirmative action and contracting for governments, expanding anti-discrimination laws and policies, improving public education. But you didn't mention anywhere electing different kinds of public officials, and that's what we look at a lot on this show. Why not? Why didn't you talk about the electoral composition of the United States as a factor here?
You know, that's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, you have situations, I mean, for instance, I think both of us were involved in some of the struggles to elect African-American urban mayors. And I think that the record is quite mixed in terms of what people have been able to do in those situations. It seems to us...
Have been able to do or have been willing to do?
Well...
I mean, what's going on here? When people get elected, did they abandon their principles? Did they get taken into the establishment and then say, I'm not who I once was when I was coming up anymore? Is that what you're saying?
That's what you're saying, Larry. what I'd say...
That's what I've seen.
what I'd say is that certainly people have difficulties in governing, and that's a different... Governing is a different proposition than running for elections. But there are also all kinds of factors, I mean, currently, which I think may in fact change that around. If you look at the current trend towards devolution, we're moving back to a time of states' rights, and what's going to be, I think, very interesting is the power of local administrators, particularly at the level of governor, to be able to distribute public capital within the states. So it makes state elections actually, I think, a little more interesting than they've been in the past. Although, if you look at the allocation of monies that have been distributed to urban centers, I think you can see a decline. I mean, as well as with the public service programs and the cuts in all kinds of service programs that we've seen.
Well, if the American people are going to continue to elect Congresses like the one elected in 1994, which overwhelmingly in the freshman Republican class represented the kind of suburban district we were just talking about before, where people of color are in a tiny minority, then I don't think there'll be any reversal of that pattern, do you?
Well, it seems to me that you have to look at ideology as well as color. And what I think has had devastating effects on low-income people, you know, and people of color, has been the kinds of policies that have been promulgated by a conservative Congress, not simply a suburban Congress.
That's Gary Delgado of the Applied Research Center. We're also talking here with Libero Delocchiano. I have to identify your voices every once in a while so people will know to whom to attribute these opinions. But I want to get back again to voting. And I want to ask you why you think it is that although approximately 25% of the American population now are people of color, when we look at election results, we'll get participation somewhere down in the 15-16% range, Libero. Why is that? What can be done to change it?
Well, I think there's a huge number of reasons, and people have tried to track that. One of the classic ones is that people pin voting numbers to poverty. And of course, people of color have higher rates of poverty than white people do. And so based purely on economics, there's going to be a lower voter turnout. But there are more reasons. I think, for instance, in California, you find that people of color have seen a number of anti-immigrant, anti-affirmative action, racist measures around three strikes you're out through the electoral process and identify, in fact, in some ways, popular voting with attacks on their communities or on their families. And so to some degree, the whole electoral system is sort of, implicated by that. And I also think that you see historically that large voter turnout by minority populations is pinned to political movements and mass movements, social movements. So, of course, in the 60s and in the 70s, you find that people of color, or African Americans specifically, were voting at higher percentages than white communities because there was a sense of we're going to hitch ourselves to this train. There's hope. There's a movement that has an agenda, and we're going to vote along with that agenda. And that now you see that as that social movement has disappeared, there is no hope. So that, even going out to vote in your interest of your community, to whatever, it seems hopeless. There's nothing out there moving.
Gary?
Well, in California, in the 94 election, for instance, we have a population that is 47% people of color and an electorate that's 81% white. And in part, that has to do with some of the things that Libro said around the way the issues were cut, but it also has to do with a policy which is actually not quite as old in this country as some people seem to think, and that's the policy of not allowing non-citizens to vote. As recently as last year in Tacoma Park, Maryland, they recently allowed people who are not citizens to vote in school board elections. That's the practice in Chicago. That's the practice in New York City. And it's actually a campaign that's being waged by the Northern California Immigrant Rights Coalition here in California. Contrary to popular belief, immigrants pay more in taxes than they receive in services. And if we're going to be true to a rhetoric of democratic participation, it makes sense, in fact, to allow avenues for all people to participate politically. So I think that's a big wedge and a big sort of blockage for people to be able to vote.
What are you going to say to people this year? What would you say if you were out there in the streets, in your communities, conducting voter registration, and you came up against the mental set, which I have certainly come against, that Libero was talking about just now, that the system's racist, no matter what way I vote isn't going to make any difference, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think you could say to people to overcome that? We have people who listen to this broadcast, who are organizers, who are out there trying to work, getting people to register and vote. What would you counsel them to say in their communities?
I think that one way to really rebuild people's confidence in their own power, their own potential to change things at the ballot box, is to rebuild social movements. And that if you're going to successfully defeat an attack on affirmative action, for instance, you have to have not just a get out the vote, you not just have a voter education, and knock on people's doors, but you have to have a mass movement. You have to turn people out into the streets and really build that kind of hope in the ability for people to change things for the better.
How do you build that kind of hope, Gary? Do you say to them? What's the mass movement? Where is it coming from?
Well, I think we have an emerging new model in California. I think one of the superb organizing efforts has been launched by Californians for Justice, which has looked at a number of policies since we know that the initiative campaign arena is one that conservative forces have basically taken to make attacks on not only people of color, but also gay and lesbian people and women. They've said, look, we're going to build an organization that's going to go past November. We're going to build an organization that's going to not only have the capacity to get people out to vote, but is also going to talk about what some proactive political proposals are that we can develop. And they've started a process which I think is actually very interesting. They have 80 organizations participating in Northern California and have built a coalition in Southern California of 40 organizations that's committed to going past November, to bring people out in November around Prop 109, but also to go past that to talk about what a progressive force would look like.
One of the things I think you've been working on at the Applied Research Center is the whole question of how public opinion is formed, especially through polls, and how people of color may not be adequately represented in polling data, which we hear about all the time. Who's ahead in what horse race, how a proposition might do. We know that polling, when it comes out, can tend to encourage or depress voting, depending on how it looks. What have you found so far in that research you've been doing?
Well, we found that there are a number of sort of methodological problems. There's, you know, the notion of sampling error, which essentially is the percentage of people who are not polled. If you look at telephone polls in California, you can have as high as 65% of people who are non-respondents to a poll. Now, that doesn't look at all as at who they're calling. They're calling, first of all, people who have telephones, which leaves out some part of the population. Secondly, they're calling people who only speak English. That leaves out a significant portion of the population. And usually what they use as a list are voter rolls. So once again, the opinion of people that you see in the newspaper is often the opinion of a very small part of the population. And I mean, it sort of goes back to if you look at voting, it is clear that's actually comparable, since we can go back to 1980. A third of the eligible voters elected Ronald Reagan, and we look at who they actually poll. Well, it's actually less than that. We estimate that it's actually probably 20% of the eligible opinions out there that the current polling operations get in contact with. And we're in fact advocating what we call an emerging California poll, which would be more comprehensive, which would include focus groups in languages that were appropriate, and would actually talk to people as well as phone.
Of course, polls of voters are valid insofar as they measure voters. If you poll non-voters, you may get their opinions, but if they're not going to vote, it's really not relevant in an electoral sense.
Although, if you're talking about an a democratic arena where you attempt to govern for the benefit of all of the people, then you have to at least know what all of the people think. And if you're going to be a good representative of the people, it seems to me that it's incumbent upon you to solicit those kinds of opinions.
Well, one of the things we try not to do on this program is to confuse small-d democracy with the current electoral system, which it certainly doesn't represent. I think we have listeners out there who might be interested in getting a copy of the very well-researched and revealing report that the Applied Research Center did called Deliberate Disadvantage about Race Relations in Northern California. It, I think, has resonance for people who live in many other parts of the country as well. Where can they call to get one?
They can call area code 510-465-9577.
And we want to thank Gary Delgado and Libero Della Piano with Pacific Affairs National Correspondent Larry Bensky. They're with the Applied Research Center in Oakland, California. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin, help from Bernard White, our engineer, and Brother Shine, Janice K. Bryant, and Errol Maitland. I'm Amy Goodman for Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!